Well, today we are in Acts chapter 23, beginning in the 12th verse. We don't have the scripture itself written out, but we do have the outline in your bulletin or online. The online version has it all written out. But we want to look at how God favorably intervenes in life. I was wondering if anyone here has ever had a close call with death, where this was life and death, just all of a sudden like a miracle. Caleb, I see that part of a hand raised.
Probably more than we realize.
Yeah. You know, it seems like sometimes you're in a car and you were stopped at a red light and you're all upset, and then you drive a block away from it and find out there was an accident that took place just when you would have been there. Or perhaps in war that's happened, in a hospital room, or in some foolish, childish-like adventure where your guardian angel has to work overtime to keep you still breathing. Well, you know, we've been looking at Paul's life since Acts chapter 9, when God intervened in his life spiritually. And I thought about how God worked to get Paul, miraculously sparing his life. Remember, he was saved. He went into Damascus. It's exciting. And everybody wanted to kill him. So they let him out in the clothes hamper down the wall. And he went out at night. He went to Jerusalem to tell his story. They tried to kill him. He had to go for 3 years out into the deserts of Arabia. In Iconium, on his first missionary journey, they tried to stone him, and he left. He said, I'm not going to stay here. So he went to Lystra, where they did stone him and left him for dead. And God intervened. In Philippi, he was beaten and jailed and stuck there in chains and stocks in an earthquake when the whole jail came down around him. And what was Paul doing? He was singing, don't worry, be happy. I'm not sure exactly. It doesn't tell us what song he was singing. He was giving praise to God. God intervened again. In Ephesus, there was a riot. God intervened and moved him out. In Corinth, they said, Paul's got all this money to take back to Jerusalem. He's getting on a ship, and there was a plot to throw him overboard. He ended up going overland back up to Philippi to escape. And in the temple now, we in the last couple of sermons in Acts chapter 21 and 22, we've seen him about torn apart at the hands of a mob, and then with the theological leaders, about torn apart again. He had to be rescued twice by the Roman soldiers. God intervened, and I don't want to be a spoiler alert here, but he's going to be on a shipwreck in a while here. We're going to read in another chapter or two. He's going to be on an island bitten by a poisonous snake that's 100% fatal, except if God intervenes. And so God had a plan for the master theologian to write almost half the New Testament and give us particular, inspired, breathed by God words that could be passed on and translated into every generation, into every language. And then for Paul himself to go through the Roman world to Caesar himself. So we concluded last message last Sunday in Acts 22 verses 1 to 12 or 1 to 11 when Paul was so discouraged and didn't look like anything was going to happen correctly. God stood with him and said, there's work to be done. There's more to do. You're going to be able to go all the way to Caesar. You're going to deal with the governors and the kings. You're going to be able to give the message out. And Paul went to sleep confident and secure in the promise of God. That doesn't mean everything's going to go perfectly. It doesn't mean everything's going to happen correctly the way we experience them, or that we're not going to ever suffer, and that we're going to always be blessed. Jesus didn't say, Paul, you just won the Super Bowl and you get a chance to go to Disney World. No, Paul, you're going to get to Rome. He didn't even mention, Paul, I'm going to send you to Rome free. we're going to let the government pay. Let them build the boat, or whatever the word might have been at that time. The idea here is that he said, okay, I understand this. At the end of his ministry, in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 12, he said, all who live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer. He adds the word persecution. But the idea is that we suffer. We preach a gospel that is able to save everyone, no matter their ethnicity, no matter their nationality, no matter their culture, no matter their gender, no matter anything. The word of God is powerful. The grace of God can save everyone. And there are a lot of people that don't want us to preach that message. They want the power. They want the authority. They don't want us to preach the way we do. So, what happened? Simple two-point message. Didn't take much to figure out an outline in this text. Today, the intervention of God, when man plotted against Paul again, and then how God providently intervened again, and the lessons we can learn from it. So let's look at man's plot to begin with. The plan is told in verses 12 and 13. When morning came, now remember, Paul's weary. He just had a vision, not just a vision, the Lord appeared to him, a miracle. Talked with him, said, don't worry. Be of good cheer, the actual word. When morning came, the Jews made a plot, bound themselves by an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. Then a little parenthesis, there were more than 40 who did this. So, the morning afterwards, Paul wakes up thinking, all right, Lord, what's going to happen today? I've got your promise. I've got your word. What's going to unfold? He had no idea that across town, this cabal of assassins was meeting, ready to vow, and things would not happen exactly the way Paul thought they would happen that day. If Paul couldn't be killed with the appearance of legality by the riot in the temple, the next day by meeting with the Sanhedrin, they figured, hey, we're going to get permission, we'll stone him to death, he'll be done. It didn't work out legally, so now, okay, we'll take matters into our own hands. We'll get a selected group to assassinate him. Now, when the Old Testament, even the New Testament, use the word 40, most of the time that's a Jewish idiom that means a month or so. Just like we would say a month or so. How long is a month or so? It's about a month or so, right? 20, 30, 40 days, somewhere in there. If I said, okay, I'll tell you what a month or so means when you come back to see me in a couple days. When are you going to come back? What does a couple days mean? So this is an idiom. It's always used. So if it says, oh, they were 40 days in the wilderness, or they were 40 days here or there, that's a generic term. But when they're counting noses, when you actually count people and say, oh, there are 40 or more, you know what it means then? There were 40 or more. That's what it means. It's an actual, we're counting noses here. It's not an idiom. It's just a way that these people are there. And they cursed a curse that curses themselves. It's wonderful to try and translate that from the Greek, because they cursed themselves with a curse on themselves. Okay? They said, we're not going to eat or drink. We will rather die if we don't kill that man. So the group said, okay, we got to get some way that we can do this and still save our own skin. So we move from the conspiracy to the collusion here of this plan. They had to get the help of the high priest, Hananiah, and the council. Well, look at what verse 14 says. They went to the chief priests and the elders and said, we've strictly bound ourselves with an oath to not even taste food till we've killed Paul. Now, Therefore you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune. Remember, the tribune is in charge of 10 centurions, 1,000 men. He's the head honcho in Jerusalem. He said, tell him that we want you to bring down Paul as though you're going to determine his case more exactly. And we're ready to kill him before he even comes near you. Hey, everybody will be covered this way. The tribune will send him down. Now, what's the tribune going to do? He's going to send down the guard and the two soldiers chained, one to each arm of Paul, and send them down to the Sanhedrin. So you got 40 or more assassins going to wait somewhere between the Antonia Fortress and where the Sanhedrin wants to meet, and somewhere in between so that nobody's going to be blamed. They're just going to kill the guards, kill Paul, just kill them all. It's easy peasy, right? Simple plan. How can anything go wrong? They couldn't succeed unless they had the full cooperation of the Sanhedrin. And so they give this plan of premeditated murder, and here are these guys who are the highest law keepers in Israel. And they go, oh sure, sounds like a good idea. We'll break the law because the ends justify the means. We can get by with doing that. It's just going to kill a couple of Roman guards and Paul. We'll take care of it. And so they wanted the Sanhedrin to lie and do good, or do bad, obviously, so the greater good would come, that we'd get rid of Paul because he is such a thorn in the flesh. So, what happened? This reads like a John Grisham novel, I think, doesn't it? Something happened here that I don't understand. There's no antecedent to it. It just comes in verse 16. Luke's story continues. Now Paul's nephew heard about the ambush. What does that scream in your brain? Who is Paul's nephew? Who is Paul's sister? Who's any of Paul's family? And how did he hear about the secret plot to kill Paul? And he's just a kid. Most people think he was 13 or 14 years old. Paul's nephew heard about the ambush. So he walked into the barracks to talk to Paul. What's wrong with that picture? How does a 13 or 14 year old Jewish boy walk into the Roman barracks and say, I'm going to talk with my uncle Paul? And they let him. And Paul called one of the centurions and said, take this young man to the tribune. Uh-oh, there's the chief guy, the highest soldier in the land, the colonel. For he has something to tell him. Paul doesn't give any inclination. There's all sorts of the shrouded mystery around this. It's like Luke just gives us enough to wonder about and then realizes it's not important for us to know all the details. We don't need to know about. You know, it got me thinking. Paul could not be a member of the Sanhedrin without two facts that had to be, if you were elected, 35 Pharisees, 35 Sadducees, and the high priest. They had this ruling council. They had to be chosen by the council, to be a member. Two things. One, you had to be married. And two, you have to have a male heir, a son, that's going to carry on. As if you're a Pharisee, you know, you're the son of a Pharisee. And if you're on the Sanhedrin, you have to. Okay, what do we know about Paul's wife? Nothing. What do we know about Paul's son? Nothing. What do we know about Paul's sister? Nothing. What do we know about his nephew, his 13-year-old nephew, who walked down into the barracks chit-chatting with the enemy soldiers? It's like God says, you don't need to sweat the details. When I'm in charge, I'll take care of the details. When I intervene, it doesn't matter how I do it or who I use. I can use an old guy, can hardly walk. I can use a young teenager who nobody even likes or respects, and they don't have any. Yeah, I can use a little boy with a sack lunch with, what do you have, five 5 barley bagels and 2 fish, or was it 2 bagels and 5 fish? I forget the story. I love that's one of my favorite miracles of Jesus, the guy who loaves and fishes. I love that. That's my kind of guy. But, you know, it doesn't, okay, bad, I know. I get this rolled eye look from the front row here. The idea here is that God uses this, and how he did that, it didn't just happen. There are no accidents with God. Somebody said, when I hurt my feet this week and had to be rushed in and have my feet doctored up, and you know, they said, well, that's a terrible accident. My wife immediately corrected him and said, no, it was stupidity. He shouldn't have been doing what he did, because that's what wives do. They correct what their husbands say. That's part of the marriage vows. Wasn't it for all of you? That was in my marriage vow, right there, written right out. No accident whatsoever. Paul heard with his intellect. You know, intellect, we know a fact. Uh-oh, there's an ambush set up for me. Wisdom is, what are you going to do with the fact? And he says, I can tell the centurion, but I'm not sure what he can do at all. But I can say, centurion, take this kid to the tribune, to the colonel, and let him talk to him. And so Paul did just that. In the days of uncertainty as to what to do, well, we know facts. Lord, give us wisdom how we should act. We don't know what to do. We read the word. We pray. We do what God says to do. So what happened? Acts 23:18. So he took him to the tribune and said, Paul, the prisoner, asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something important to tell you. The tribune, we know his name is Claudius Lysias from a few verses ahead. The tribune took him by the hand and, going aside privately, said, okay, what do you want to tell me? Okay. Again, I just read the story and I go, okay, Paul is a prisoner. He tells the centurion what to do. And the centurion says, yes, sir. That doesn't make sense. The centurion now leaves the general courtyard, goes into the colonel's office, and said, Paul told me to do this, so here he is. He has something important. Sounds like Paul's in charge of this whole thing. Well, Paul isn't, but God is. And God is working out the details in a way that nobody expects. And so Claudius Lysias, the tribune, takes this young man, again, 12, 13, 14 years old, takes him by the hand. He's like a grandpa. Takes him by the hand, goes into a private room, and says, okay, you're nervous. You're in the enemy fortress. Now you're talking to the highest official. If you say the wrong word, I'll have you killed. That's the power that's here. And so the young man says, all right, and told him the details, verses 20 and 21. He said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. Don't be persuaded by them. More than 40 men are lying in ambush. They bound themselves by an oath not to eat or drink till they've killed him. And even now, they're just waiting for your agreement. As soon as you give the word, the plan will go into action. Remember, Paul is a prisoner for his own protection from the Jewish mob, from the Jewish leaders. He's a Roman citizen, and the tribune has a duty to guard him. And he realizes, if anything this boy is telling me is true, we've got to act now. So, the provision. Verse 22, the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, don't tell anyone what you've just told me. He wanted to protect this young man. Did it protect this young man? I don't know. I don't even know the guy's name. But God was in control of a Roman general or colonel or whatever he'd be there to take care of him, to keep the boy safe, since he was now an informer. And the Tribune realized, I've got to deal with this today. I can't wait for another day to go by and send Paul down. Even if I send a bigger guard with him, you know, what could I send? You know, 40 or more assassins waiting? They're going to kill him? I can't allow an innocent man to be torn apart on my watch. So, verse 23, he called two of the centurions and said, get ready 200 soldiers. Each centurion had 100 soldiers. That's why they were called centuri, they 100. They each had that. And 200 lancers, that's heavy brigade of cavalry, and 70 light brigade. I could start quoting a poem by Tennyson, but I won't, just for your edification. The idea is, now you're thinking, wait a minute, Pentecost is over, the feast is over, there are 1,000 Roman soldiers and their tribune in Jerusalem to keep the peace in that entire central area of Judea. How many soldiers is he sending out? Do the math. I'll wait. Do the math. 200 foot. 470. You get a. Now there's no more. You ate them all. There's no more rolls over there. Okay. 470. God said, Paul, I'm going to take care of you. And God, I think just there's just a smile here as God exaggerates and said, you want to know how I'm going to take care of you? You're not just going to have a Roman soldier. You're just not going to have two. How about half of all the soldiers in central Palestine are all going to take care of you? Get ready 200 soldiers, 200 lancers, 70 cavalry to leave at 9 p.m. tonight to go to Caesarea. Caesarea or Caesarea, depending on how you want to mispronounce it. But Caesarea Maritime, there's another Caesarea up in the other side of the Sea of Galilee. But Caesarea Maritime is the capital city. That would be like saying, okay, get ready a bunch of highway patrol and police cars and a couple of fire trucks, everything, whatever you got, and head down to Cheyenne. Okay, that's the generic, the way we'd look at it today. God exaggerated his faithfulness to Paul, saying, I'm going to provide this escort for you. It'll keep you safe, and you don't even have to walk. I'm going to have them provide rides for you, and in case there is an ambush, in case there's trouble, I'm not just going to provide one horse. We'll bring some extra horses too. Notice that he'll provide mounts, plural, for Paul. Paul is not that big. He didn't need two horses to ride on. But in case one was injured or something, we're going to make sure Paul gets there. God's promise is true. Even when you look at all this and say, how could all these things all work out together? Now, sunset on the day after, or on the week after Pentecost in 58 AD is 6:50 p.m. In case anybody's interested, that's the kind of thing I read that and said, oh, okay, we're going to go there. So I went immediately online. Did you know you can Google any date, any year, and it will tell you what the sunrise and sunset, it'll tell you the temperature in Jerusalem. To me, that's amazing. So 6:50, sunsets. The colonel said 9 o'clock, pitch dark now. I want you to be ready to get Paul mounted and get out of here. I don't want to give any time for the conspirators to have opportunity to adjust their plan. I want a big group, especially footmen with them, when they leave Jerusalem, they've got to go about 40 miles down to the big city at the springs that feed the Yarkon River. Now this is all hill country here. These are all hills. And then it gets out into the plains of Sharon, the Rose of Sharon. You're all familiar with that type thing. I'm not going to stand up. The idea here, to get through the rough country, down the valleys and the hills where there might be an ambush. Once you get to Antipatris, once you get there, then it's just wide open plain all the way down to Caesarea, another 40 miles or so. And so half of the soldiers went with, half of them going to just go down through the danger area, and then the rest can take Paul the rest of the way. So that's the whole plan, and now the plan interrupted. It brings us to the second part, God's providence. What God did here. Verse 25 picks up the story of Acts 23. Because for the tribune to send the prisoner to the governor, they got to have some sort of charges. They have to have some sort of explanation. Why are we doing this? And so he wrote a letter. Literally, that's what the next verse begins. Verse 25, he wrote a letter to this effect. Claudius Lysias, to His Excellency the Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews, was about to be killed by them, when I came upon them with my soldiers and rescued him, knowing that he was a Roman citizen. Now, remember the last couple messages? This is not exactly accurate, but it sure makes Claudius Lysias look like a good guy. He said, and desiring to know the charges for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. So here we have this tribune. Remember, he's already met with Paul. He's already talked with Paul. He's already realized that Paul was born a Roman citizen, where he had to buy his citizenship. His citizenship was granted by the Emperor Claudius, so that he took his name. And then Lysias, or Lysias, which is a Greek name, he's trying to explain this, that, okay, I'm a Roman citizen, I'm your centurion here, but, you know, I'm the guy that's trying to take care of this matter in Jerusalem. He didn't get things done the easy way that he thought he could by having Paul talk to the crowd or talk to the council. But he said, Governor, this is the situation. Now, Governor Felix was a wicked man. The historian Tacitus of Rome said that Marcus Antonius Felix was one of the most cruel and selfish leaders. He and his brother Pallas were both slaves. They were slaves to Mark Antony's daughter, and because of that gained their freedom and had inroads into the government. And Pallas became a confidant of Claudius the emperor, and Felix, the other slave brother, is made the governor of the entire province here. So we're dealing with people who are pretty high up, pretty involved in the legal situation of the day. And yet God brought these men together, because God does that and intervened, and God took care of having, you know, a former slave be the governor that Paul is going to get to talk to. Paul knows his background. Paul would be aware of who Felix is. And he knew who Claudius Lysias was, and made this all happen. Well, keep reading here. His letter, he writes to the governor, I found he was being accused about questions of their law, charged with nothing deserving death or even jail time. When it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against this man, I immediately sent him to you, and I ordered his accusers to state before you the charges they have against him. You see, he was not guilty. I think part of the reason Luke writes this and includes this little episode in the book of Acts is so that Romans reading the book of Acts, they were probably going to read this in Rome itself, that they would see, oh, Christianity's not a bad thing. They're not trying to overthrow the government. The way, one of the early names for the Christian church and believers. They were acquitted. They weren't guilty of anything. They didn't deserve death. They didn't deserve jail time. Who knows if this letter that went to Caesarea in a couple of years when Paul is sent to Rome, if that letter doesn't continue as part of the package of evidence. And so Luke says that no law is broken. There's no fear here. Christianity is good. And nobody corrects the details here that Lysias didn't know Paul was a Roman citizen. He was going to beat him, going to whip him. He had him already bound, again, all illegal. And those are just kind of overlooked real quickly by the letter here. But the message was given, and the governor could get the gist of it. We're not worried about the details, just like we weren't worried about the name of Paul's sister or nephew or whatever. Doesn't matter. We're getting him to safety. Verse 31. So the soldiers, just as they were instructed, took Paul through the night to Antipatris. The following day, they, the foot soldiers, the 200, returned to their barracks and let the cavalry go on alone with him. Once they got out of the danger area through the night, then the next day the cavalry could keep going, the soldiers could walk the 40 miles uphill back to Jerusalem. Again, it's just a beautiful picture here how God provided and even gave the name of the place. By the way, if you read in the Old Testament in 1 Samuel, and Antipatris in the New Testament was Aphek, A-P-H-E-K, in the Old Testament. And that was the place where the Jews came down to fight the Philistines from the, you know, they came out of the hills down here to the plains to fight the Philistines. They lost, and the Ark of the Covenant was taken. Okay, just pull your brain back to those days of Samuel and Eli and the priest in after the book of Judges as it concludes. So they went as far as that area and went down to this wonderful fortress, Antipatris, named after Antipater, who was Herod the Great's father, and he had built fortresses all over. You probably think of Masada, the Herodium, all these different fortresses all over the area. And this is one of them that he built there at the headwater springs of the Yarkon. And the fear of the ambush was over by the time they reached there. And so then life could go back to normal. Verse 33 ends this part of the journey. It says, when they reached Caesarea, they delivered the letter to the governor and also presented Paul to him. The plot was stymied. It was done. You know, the first question I asked about this is probably the same question that Kathy's grinning from ear to ear. What question would you ask?
Did they ever eat again?
Did they ever eat again? No, they all just starved to death because they made a vow. And remember Jephthah and the vow he made about his daughter? Okay. No. They didn't die of hunger, by the way. The Jews said a vow before God is unbreakable. You can't break it. You can't, you know, if you made a vow that says, I'm going to kill this guy or I'm going to die trying, or whatever the vow, however it was worth. I'm taking an oath against myself, an oath. But the Jewish rabbis, the Sanhedrin, the council said, okay, now a vow is sacred, you can't break it, you made an oath, but if you vowed to incite or riot, that's illegal activity. Somebody should explain that today, but if you made a vow to do that, you can say, oh man, I can't do that, that would be breaking the law. Oh, so you're free. Vow doesn't count anymore. You can eat, thank you. Second type, if you exaggerate it. Second type of vow, this is in the Jewish Talmud, a vow of exaggeration. I'm going to do that, or I'll never eat again. Now, doesn't that sound like a little bit of hyperbole? You all know what a hyperbole is? Okay, three of you are looking at me like you do. The rest, okay, it's an exaggeration. It's saying it for an effect, for impact. If you made a vow exaggerating, oh, you're free from that vow. Go ahead and eat dinner. If you made a vow in error, no big deal. If you made it by mistake, it doesn't count. Go ahead and have dinner. If you have a vow that can't be fulfilled because it's illegal, because you'll be arrested if you keep it, like murdering Roman guards and Paul, that might be considered illegal. If you made a vow, it's not important. You can break it, no penalty. Say three Our Fathers, five Hail Marys, and go on, well, whatever they would say. In other words, the exclusion was for any contingency. It's like my wedding vows, right? 50 years ago this last week, 50 years. Just think about that. My father-in-law stood with a shotgun. Said, if you don't marry my daughter, I'll send you to jail for 50 years. I'd be a free man right now if I hadn't done that. 50 years ago, I made vows. And it said, for better or worse, in sickness and in health, for richer or poorer. Now, I assume, like everybody else making those vows, I'm going to always be healthy. It's always going to be better. And wealthy. Oh, yeah, I can't forget that one. And some other vow in there, too, I forget. I don't forget, please. All the teenagers are looking at me like, what, you forgot your vows? No, the people today, what's a vow mean? Oh, I like somebody else better. I don't love her anymore. He doesn't make enough money. Boom. Vows mean nothing. Don't laugh at the Jews who are eating dinner after Paul escapes, because that's exactly what's happening in our society. So the cavalry won the day. Final part of this story, verses 34 and 35. There was a little bit of a pause here just to make sure at the governor's office. Verse 34, on reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. And he learned that he was from Cilicia. Now, again, statistics you don't need to memorize forever, but in the Roman Empire, there were three types of provinces that you were in. You could be in a local province. They would have a local king or a local governor or somebody there that would be in charge. That's what Judea was like at the time when Jesus was born. Herod was the king. Now, he was under Rome, but Judea was run by King Herod. You could have a senatorial district. That would be an area that was conquered. The Senate meets together and says, okay, here is Gaul. We call it France today. We're going to form a province of Gaul. It's not really part of the Roman Empire, but it's a senatorial district. Or it can actually be an imperial province, which the imperial jurisdiction of Cilicia, which would be in northern Turkey, just above the top here, if you took our map and went on up through Lebanon and around the corner. That's where Paul was from, Tarsus in Cilicia. And so the governor's just saying, I just got to make sure that I'm the right jurisdiction here, that you're at the right place. And he was, because he's the Roman-appointed governor of the whole region. And so he said, all right, verse 35, I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive. And he commanded Paul to be guarded in Herod's palace, the praetorium, the big hall of Herod's palace. So here we see a little bureaucratic justice. Okay, I got the story. You're safe. You're here. I'm not going to put you in prison. I'm not going to put you in chains. You're obviously a Roman citizen. We'll just keep you here at the palace. And when the Jews from Asia come, because remember, that's who did the problem. The Jews in Asia said to Paul at the temple, He's the one that's turning the Jews against the law of Moses. So when they come, we'll discuss it. We'll take care of the matter. Now, no accuser is going to come. We know that. But that doesn't bother justice. The law is, he's the right guy in charge. He's got to find the accusation, the plaintiff, and then the defense, and weigh out all the details. And so Paul is now in a palace built by Herod the Great. He's just got to wait. And he knows there's not an issue here because, you know, the Jews that said that, it was all a lie. It wasn't anything valid at all. And they're not even going to be able to be found to come down and condemn him. And so Paul just waits. And he realizes, hey, what God promised me. Remember back verse 11 before the sermon today? Jesus said, I'll be with you. You'll preach before kings. You'll go all the way to Rome. Paul's going, hey, I just made the first journey. They even provided a horse for me. Here I am safe and sound in the palace. No fear. Okay, I'll wait for the trial. It's not a problem. This was his first step in the next phase of his ministry. We've just enjoyed looking at him being saved and trained, and now three missionary journeys, and now he begins what we call the fourth, or the missionary journey to Rome, as he begins here. The rest of Acts is going to cover the next 5 years and all that happens. Paul's under arrest the whole time, but God is still with him. God's still taking care of him. God's still in control. The promises are still there. And when Paul needs it, God's going to still intervene and take care of him. Now, if we view this story from the eyes of a Roman, how would you like to be Claudius Lysias, the Roman commander? The chaotic life of Paul. It's like a nonstop riot. No pun intended. It literally is just a mess. But he's a good soldier. He's dedicated. He wants to uphold the law. But he's totally lost. This story doesn't mean anything. He doesn't see God in it. He doesn't see salvation in it. He doesn't see that he's a sinner and Paul's a saint because he's trusted Christ and had his sins taken. All he knows is none of this makes sense. I don't understand the gospel. I don't understand Paul. I don't understand why all the Jews are opposed to him. In the big picture of the world, the unbeliever is clueless about what's happening. But to the Christian that Luke is writing this story about, to those that Paul is ministering to the churches all over Europe now and all over the Middle East, the Christian life is not going to be easy. It's not going to be safe. It's not going to be comfortable. It's a continuation of trouble. If your life doesn't have problems, you got to kind of look and think, am I really a Christian? Is this what God wants me to do? There should be problems. Because the life of a Christian involves suffering. It involves what Paul wrote to the Roman church in chapter 8, verse 28, that we know that all things work together for the good of those who love him, who are the elect according to his purpose. God's going to take care of him. I read this and I say, thank you, Lord, that my eyes are open. I can see your hand. It gives me hope. When trouble happens to me, it might be minor issues, like burning my feet. And my wife saying, I'll take you quick to the hospital. And then goes to her car, which hasn't been run for 120 days. And it goes click, 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 click. And she says, and I can't drive your car. And I said, why? It's brand new. It's only got 200 miles on it. And she says, I've never driven it before. And I said, God will take care, but don't rip the mirror off as you back out of the garage. You all understand that concept. You say, a minor detail. Yeah, God's giving us hope. Hope that his sovereignty, his promises, his provision in the midst of the chaos and conflict and confusion and blundering of our human lives, he is there. God is not some grandpa sitting up in a rocking chair in heaven, looking down and wringing his hands, saying, "Oh, I just can't understand all the trouble in the world." God is in control. And God will still intervene, from the littlest issue to the greatest. It doesn't take a burning bush. God can use an unnamed kid, a teenager. He can use a confused Roman colonel. He can use a bunch of soldiers who are probably grumbling the whole way, saying, "Oh yeah, it's easy now going 40 miles downhill. But in the morning when we get there, we got to turn around and go 40 miles back uphill and march. And 80-mile march, that's a long ways." See, the men don't understand. Man plans, God laughs, God smiles, God says, "Hey, trust me, I can use you to change the course of history." And that's what I pray we take away from this story. God can intervene and use each of us. You see, I'm just a kid, I'm a teenager, I'm old. I got two left feet. Well, join me. I got two burned feet. Who cares? God can use us. And we have to say, like the centurion did to Paul, "Yes, sir, whatever you want." God can use us, just like he used these circumstances to change the course of the history of the world.